psychology, and then leading up to, if possible, yoga also. I won't strictly deal with the systems of yoga, but I will try to show the psychology as developed in India under various schools of yoga, particularly the synthesis which has been arrived at by Sri Aurobindo. So that it will be a kind of new psychology, necessarily a subjective science, and one must proceed in it from the knowledge of oneself to the knowledge of others. This puts the whole of modern psychology into a mark of interrogation, because whether the modern psychologists know who they are, while all the time they are claiming to know the human personality, human psychology, and claiming to know others, for the matter of that. And also, I would like to repeat a tribute paid to Sri Aurobindo by Gabriel Mistral, the Nobel laureate winner, I think. It was written by her in the Aryan Path in February 1947. She wrote in that magazine, "While Tagore awakened the latent music in me, another Indian, Sri Aurobindo, brought me to religion. He opened the way to my religious consecration. Indeed, my debt to India is very great and is due in part to Tagore and in part to Sri Aurobindo." Now that gives you the idea of the influence which a great personality wields on contemporary intelligentsia. And also that Gabriel Mistral has never come in direct contact with Sri Aurobindo. It is by contact with his writing that she attained this sort of religious conviction and a aspiration to admit religious impulse as a very important and fundamental part of man's being. Now I will try to show a new approach to modern psychology, a plea for a new approach. That is how I have put it to myself. Man's awakening to the need of self-knowledge must have been due to various causes, external as well as internal. It is possible that the round of animal desires proved insufficient to yield any real or lasting delight to the human being. The feeling and the realization of his own imperfection and ignorance of the outer and the inner world, may have also made man aspire for more and more knowledge of himself and the world. The want of harmony which is felt within oneself, and an intuitive need of harmony, may have also contributed to man's spiritual awakening. To these negative motives must be added an incentive to self-knowledge, to the eternal and irrepressible aspiration for the state of perfection, whatever that perfection may be, that is enshrined in the heart of man from the beginning of human history. Given the very fact of death, even the very fact of death might have goaded men to inquire into the meaning of life. Life and also of existence. Perhaps while trying to make an inquiry into the nature of the world, man might have discovered that the first problem is himself. Thus he became the problem of problems. Human inquiry becomes a subjective problem, a problem of human psychology par excellence. This seems to have taken place both in the East as well as in the West. In the East, tameva atmanam janatha amrutasya setum. Know verily that self, the bridge to immortality. This was uttered by the Upanishads of Hoary antiquity. And know thyself was a command formulated by one of the oldest Greek philosophers. I think it was Plato. The attempt to acquire knowledge of self was found to lead to psychological processes such as introspection, analysis, the knowledge of various states, one's own states of being and of nature. For the self of man is first revealed to man in his ordinary, natural, that is to say, in his own psychological makeup. In Europe, as time went on, philosophical inquiry drifted away from this practical search for self, that is, from the field of direct psychological experience and inquiry. It gradually came to confine itself to mere intellectual speculation and inquire into the nature of truths and the formulation of that truth in terms of mind. Later on, it moved on to the study of matter, to the study of life, wherein European mind felt that there was a reality, and this reality could be objectively studied. In India, the tendency was to formulate a philosophical system on the basis of spiritual or psychological experiences. As a result, a great mass of psychological experience was gathered and came to be formulated in the various systems of yogas. Yoga, in fact, can be defined as a science of inner culture. Yoga is, of course, not an automatic process. It requires a conscious participation by the individual in the process of his own self-evolution. In other words, yoga is nothing else but consciously practiced practical psychology. It is true that there are various systems of yogas current in India, but it is quite possible to arrive at a synthesis of their aims and methods if the outward forms of practices are laid aside and their psychological implications clearly understood. Such a system of the principles, practices, and results of the systems of Indian yoga is a great need of the present time, and it is indispensable for the understanding of Indian psychology. Sri Aurobindo's great work on yoga achieves this purpose that is mentioned here and is an outstanding contribution to the proper study of the subject. But the modern mind, which means the European mind, is not prepared to accept the scientific nature of Indian psychology. To it, all Indian systems are empirical at their best. Modern psychology, on the contrary, claims to be scientific. It is supposed to be not empirical. It has got rid of the soul, which it characterizes to be a metaphysical entity in the field of psychology introduced by the old school of unscientific psychologists. Psychology has now become, or is at least trying hard to become, a natural science, like physics and chemistry. This effort at becoming an objective science capable of yielding experimental results verifiable by anybody by means of outer and physical evidence seems to inflict on modern psychology a double disadvantage. With all the efforts and in spite of the great contribution made by modern psychology to the knowledge of man, we must frankly confess that it is far from the exactitude of objective sciences like physics and chemistry. So far as these sciences are concerned, their basis is matter, and there is universal agreement with regard to the methods of investigation and the aim. But the same cannot be said of modern psychology. Even today, after 50 years of progress, it is divided into rival schools with diametrically opposite standpoints, such as behaviorism in introspection, gestaltism in Hormism, which shows that modern psychology as yet is far from being a natural science. One cannot say that these differences correspond to the theories that are current in physics and chemistry, because these differences are with regard to the very basic principles. The question, therefore, we have first to consider is whether methods of research which are applicable to physical sciences could be at all applied to the study of psychology. One has to accept the strictly materialistic basis of human psychology. One who accepts the strictly materialistic basis of human psychology shall have to wait, perhaps, till he is able to determine the weight of a thought or calculate the potential energy of an impulse, because that is what the natural science would demand. In fact, the study of psychology can hardly be taken up seriously unless one decides the question of this fundamental importance, namely, is matter or spirit the basis of human psychology? The question might be put differently. Who is it that experiences all the multifarious phenomena in man? Where, that is to say, in what medium do these experiences take place? Do they occur in inert matter only, or in the spirit, or in consciousness? Do they form the field of experience of a soul, a spirit? That is the question. It is true, modern psychology fought shy and deported the soul out of the domain, but then it is now finding it hard to do without what it calls a subject, what it calls an individual, what it calls a personality. Here is what a great scholar of psychology and philosophy, the late Professor R.D. Ranade, Dean of the Faculty of Philosophy, Allahabad University, has to say on this subject. He says, modern writers on psychology give no attention to rational psychology. They consider it either useless or metaphysical. As Professor James Ward points out, modern psychologists vie with each other in writing a psychology ohne Seele, without a soul. The ancient conception of soul has evaporated, and in its place we find a self which is regarded as a center of interest, into inverted commas, and which is supposed to be generated when the new interest springs up, and it is destroyed as soon as the interest terminates. The impasse into which such a view brings the psychologists may be realized at a glance when we consider that some of them have been forced to recognize the continuance of such a bloodless self even after death of the body. And in place of the old worldview of an immortal soul, we find the idea of a center of interest which survives after death of the body, when the interest is not fulfilled in the person's lifetime. Well, the old worldview, as in Plato and so in the Upanishads, planted itself squarely on the recognition of the soul as an entity, which was free to take on a body, as it was also free to go away and transmigrate. Whereas whatever the limitation of such a view, it was a view which one could at least understand. But the modern conception of an anemic center of interest, which could continue to exist after the death of the body, passes beyond the comprehension of anybody except a metaphysician who makes such a concession to naturalism as to make an entire farrago of his philosophical ideas. This is from his book, A Constructive Survey of the Upanishadic Philosophy, page 129. Well, in modern psychology, thought is explained as a result of brain discharge of the nerves, electrical discharges in the brain cells. But it is still a standing question in modern psychology whether thought is a finer and subtler state of matter, or of life, or of mind. George Russell A.E., in his book, The Candle of Vision, reports certain dream experiences of his own and asks the question about the process of its preservation in memory. How are these dreams retained in human memory? Well, there seem to be insuperable difficulties in accepting only the material basis of the faculty of dream and retention of memory. Another difficulty in adopting a strictly scientific method of psychology is that an impersonal or a purely objective observation of psychological phenomena is not possible. These phenomena always occur to someone. They are somebody's. They are not impersonal in the sense that they belong to nobody. It would be too much to claim objectivity for these experiences when even physical science is now finding that its observations are no longer strictly objective. It is argued that one can study psychological phenomena by observing the outer behavior or by the method of personal narrative as in psychoanalysis. But these devices, even at their best, can hardly claim certainty and finality with regard to the knowledge so acquired. For the outer behavior hardly gives the real or the whole clue to the inner psychological state of the individual and his movements. And the personal narrative cannot give the complete picture of all the inner movements because men are not conscious of all their inner movements. So that by studying behavior and outer, conduct, it is not possible to arrive at a correct knowledge of the inner psychological movement. A formidable difficulty in applying the outer method to the psychological field is that the whole field of investigation is complex. And the field is constantly changing. And the instruments of investigation themselves are also elastic and varying. In experiments or investigations of physical science, the changes in the field are brought about by the observing subject. And the physical elements change only in response to outer action. And even then, the changes occurring within its own structure are not conscious changes. But in psychology, the very field of investigation can participate in the investigation and in the change that occurs in oneself. The latest development in physical sciences tends to show that mind and therefore subjectivity cannot be altogether kept out from the field of even physical sciences. In fact, after all the scientific observations have been made and the proofs are given, it is the mind that is at last called in to make the final choice of the conclusions. The same holds good for psychological research in a much more pronounced manner. One more difficulty in using method of physical science in psychology is that the conditions for conducting the experiment are not known. It is high time that some methods were evolved in psychology that could be universally applied. There are many who believe in the current methods and even call these methods scientific, but all the knowledge that we possess is due to an act of imaginative identification or to a sort of analogy. By a sort of consensus of opinion, we decide upon certain conditions which the scientists would perhaps strongly object to and dub as unscientific. A still more fundamental objection to the employment of scientific method to psychology is that these methods are merely extension of the functioning of human senses. And therefore, the generalization arrived at would also be dependent upon the same basis. Methods pursued by physical science have not proved adequate in explaining the structure and nature of the material world, so that its application to a field of inner research becomes far more questionable. We can legitimately even ask whether there are no other methods of studying this field of knowledge, I mean the field of psychology. It is claimed that though the method pursued in psychological investigations are not strictly physical, still they aim at a systematic study. If that is the case, and if testing a so-called empirical process by practical experiment and checking of the result constitutes a systematic study, then the Indian system of Hatha Yoga and the Raj Yoga at least can claim to be scientific. As a matter of fact, each system of yoga, such as the Jnana Yoga, Karma Yoga, or Bhakti Yoga, or Tantra, has its own system, which prescribes practical methods, indicates the results, and supplies the test to check up the achievement and the results. The Indian standpoint in psychology assumes the spirit as the basis of the cosmos. It admits the waking condition of consciousness, and also it admits a subconscious state of being, even as modern psychology does. But it admits in addition what modern psychology knows nothing about. It admits a superconscient. It admits a condition of consciousness above the present mental level of men. Modern psychology would perhaps like to relegate the superconscient to the realm of the abnormal. From the spiritual standpoint of view, what appears to be abnormal is only a sign of what is to evolve in future. It is a precursor of what is to come. A little reflection will show that this superconscient is not an isolated state, but is inclusive of all that it exceeds. It acts in everyday life of the individual, even in and through their waking state of consciousness. Besides, this superconscient finds expression in various cultural activities and attainments of the human being. The attempt here is not to make a detailed classification of the states of consciousness actual and possible to man. The intention here is to show that what is considered abnormal, magical, wonderful, or supernatural, or supra-sensual is not something quite remote from the field of everyday experience of men. These experiences pertain to various fields. On the physical level, we see the phenomenon of faith cure, of poison eating, of fire walking without any undesirable consequences. And we also know of several kinds of materialization. On the plane of life, we find hypnotism, telepathy, clairvoyance, and other similar phenomena, which have been scientifically tested and proved genuine. While these faculties are indications of the presence of the supraphysical and the possibility of their attainment. There are powers and faculties in man which give him an insight into the knowledge of the future. Visions, premonitions, prophecies are possible to man's consciousness. Over and above these faculties, which are relegated generally to the supraphysical, there are regular branches of human culture which require the use of and which depend upon the exercise of faculties that indicate the existence of the supra-rational in man. Religion, astrology, poetry, plastic arts, very often depend upon the action of some supra-rational faculty in man for their highest creation. The undying aspiration of the whole human race for a divine perfection or fulfillment bear witness to the pull of the superconscient which it exercises on man. Intuition, inspiration, and revelation are some of the faculties connected with the superconscient which have found expression in various fields of human activity. With some little observation about Indian psychology. Indian psychology bases its acceptance of the superconscient on concrete experience, and modern psychology would remain poorer for the rejection of these fields of experience which is open to man. To limit the field of human consciousness, to limit the field of psychological experience, which has been an ever-enlarging field from the inconscient to the conscient throughout the course of evolution, would in fact be an arbitrary act. The Western view of psychology is empirical. It also suffers from an additional grave defect. All its explanations are directed to explaining consciousness, its movement and function in the light of the past. That is to say, it tries to explain the present consciousness of man by its past, but it holds out no vision for the future. In case of Indian psychology, on the contrary, the whole vision is directed to the future, to either a state of liberation or perfection, or to an identity and a growth into the superconscient higher consciousness. There is a study of dream consciousness and subconscious also. Some of the explanations of visions and dreams given by modern psychology are untenable. It is more likely that visions and dreams have an independent existence of their own on the subtle plane of consciousness. A.E., the Irish mystic, after describing a vision in which he saw everything illumined, says, "People pass them," means these visions, "by too easily, saying it is imagination, as if imagination were not a mystery. Imagination was easily explained as a problem in Euclid." He further says that if he was to construct the figures that he saw in vision or dream, it would be a work of infinite labor. But these faces of vision are not still. They move, they have life, they have expression. To say that we refashion memories is to surmise in the subconscious nature a marvelous artist to whom all that we have seen with our physical eye is present at once. And as clay in the hand of the divine potter, and it is such swift creation too that it rivals the work of the Lord. A.E. further adds, "The common psychological explanation is not acceptable because we know that form can appear in the brain, which were transferred to it by will from one person to another." The explanation about the vision full of light is that it is due to light being a vibration, and vibration affecting the eye and passing along the nerves until it is stored up in the brain cells. The vibration is stayed and fixed there. A.E. argues against this, and he says that this effect must remain unaffected in the brain, because one can after years summon the image again and find the image clear as at first. Thus the explanations of memory and imagination both break down. A.E. says it is the perception of the images already existing in the subtle. architecture of dream and vision, there is mystery which is not explained by speaking of suppressed desire or sex or any other of those springs which modern psychologists surmise are released in dream. We must suppose that memory is as fixed in its way as the sun picture is fixed, or as the attitude of a statue is fixed. If it fades, it should be by loss of precision, not into another equally precise, but different form and different gesture. From the quotations given, it is clear that dreams, visions, and figures of imagination all require more closer study and consideration than has been given to them up till now. It must also be admitted that explanations given up till now have been most inadequate. It is possible that Indian psychology and its mode of approach to these problems might pave the way for a more correct understanding of these phenomena. Now, taking up the last part of the talk, a brief survey of modern schools of psychology. We will take up a brief survey of the present-day psychology. It must be admitted that in spite of its shortcomings, modern psychology is inspired by a genuine spirit of search for truths of human consciousness. A vast literature has been created during a relatively short period of about 50 years. And since the rise of natural sciences, European mind has been principally occupied in investigating the nature of the physical world. And later on in the 18th century, it took up the field of biology. In these investigations, the attitude of the inquiring mind was objective. So, when the eye of research turned upon man and wanted to study psychology involving mental processes, he had perforce to adopt, in the beginning at least, a subjective attitude. This change to subjective field of inquiry by the European mind may be indicative of an important cultural development in Europe. Etymologically, psychology means the science of the soul. And this soul was regarded as a subjective reality by the ancients and was admitted as a metaphysical reality by the pioneers of modern psychology. The various activities of consciousness in man were regarded as manifestations of the soul. Now, a natural science which confines itself to the investigation of phenomena cannot admit a soul or any other metaphysical reality. Therefore, those investigators of the field of psychology who were anxious to enroll it as a natural science had to adopt its assumptions, premises, and methods of inquiry. Soul was no longer a permissible reality in scientific psychology. The new science of psychology began by positing a mind and its activity without considering whether an ultimate substratum of some kind was necessary for mind or not. The answer to such a question was that it was no concern of psychology as a natural science to inquire into or even to consider the question. The methods of physical science were rigorously applied to psychology, and since then psychologists have been empirically investigating mental phenomena, collecting facts, trying to arrive at generalizations with regard to various activities of consciousness. They have been studying perception, memory, imagination, thought, reasoning, will, impulse, reflexes, complexes, etc. They also try to include the study of human personality in these fields. Through the generalizations arrived at up till now, though the generalizations arrived at up till now have not yet amounted to anything more than mere beginnings, the deeper significance of this search seems to lie in the fact that the outward-turned Western mind has turned its eye upon himself and is trying now to understand or know the constitution of man, which is a very salutary change. Some will perhaps dispute the statement that psychology today is nothing more than a mere beginning of a science. But one can even go further and assert that today it is not a single science with a definite subject matter, as I told you already. In the field of modern psychology, there is such a diversity of point of view regarding even the nature of the subject matter, as also the aim and the method to be pursued, that it would be more correct to consider it as a group of sciences aiming at the study of man rather than as a single science. The standpoint of natural science adopted by chemistry, physics, and other sciences is considered inappropriate for study of psychology by writers like Dilthey, Spranger. They are against the natural science ideal for psychology. Dilthey and Spranger argue against the modernists who insist that mental phenomena should be taken as coordinate to the physical and physical phenomenon of external nature. They argue, the natural school of science, psychologists, that all values and judgments of human utility and purpose must be eschewed, and all mental activity should be investigated structurally with a view to discover the qualities possessed by them and the laws regulating their functions. Just as physics or chemistry or any other sciences study various kinds of material phenomena and seek to determine the laws of their behavior irrespective of their practical utility. Dilthey and Spranger consider this standpoint altogether inapplicable to psychology. The psychological phenomenon, they argue, is not at all coordinate with the material phenomena. A mental activity is always, without exception, a personal reference. It is somebody's, and a physical object such as a table or a chair or a plant does not possess such a personal point of reference. Mind and mental phenomena belong to the cultural development of society, to which mutual mental interaction of human personality is essential. Psychology, thus, according to them, is a cultural or social science, and therefore the method of investigation in psychology must be different from that pursued in physical sciences. This is not all. Even among those who agree in regarding psychology as a mental science, there are sharp differences about the nature of the subject matter and the aim and the method. There are some who, for example, take consciousness as a subject matter and introspection as a method of investigation. They represent what is called the introspection school of psychology. Directly opposed to this is Watson, the leader of behaviorism, who asserts that there is no such thing as consciousness and that therefore introspection is futile and superfluous. According to him, psychology is really concerned with behavior of the human individual, and he regards physics as the ideal science which psychology must follow, and he aims at making psychology an experimental and objective science. It may be suggested here that though these standpoints appear diametrically opposed to each other, they may be harmonized into a science of psychology aiming at the study of human individual in the dual aspect of activities which are mental and activities which are bodily. In the light of the cumulative evidence, it seems reasonable to hold that the contemporary mutually exclusive schools of psychology would find their synthesis most probably by adopting a radical change both in their standpoint and in their method. Gestaltism is a school of psychology which has attracted a great attention lately. Its basic idea is that the whole is not merely a sum of the parts, and that there exists what is called the gestalt quality, the quality of the whole, as distinct from that of the parts. The organism as a whole is to it a concrete reality. As regards the method, gestaltism finds the much-honored empirical method of analysis utterly defective for its purposes, and because it tends to make the parts substantial realities even more important than the whole. Gestaltism would therefore have a method competent to comprehend the complex whole, though it may allow the analysis to be used as a supplementary method. To this school of psychology, to this school, psychology is a study of psychophysical organism of the human individual. And according to it, mind and body form one whole and are not disparate entities. As an illustration of its application, we find a new explanation of the perception of motion. Movement, Gestaltism affirms, is not constructed by putting together fixed positions in successive moments of time, but that it is the result of direct perception of the sense. In other words, movement is not inferred, but is directly perceived. These three schools, introspection, behaviorism, and gestaltism, fall within the fold of empirical science of psychology. Hormism of MacDougall, making purposiveness of mind its pivot, belongs to the same class. Hormism believes that difference between the mechanical operations of physical nature and those of the mental nature is that all mental operations work towards some purpose, either conscious or unconscious. And this purposiveness explains the manifold activities of human mind and its behavior. Now, that one more school. In a way, the most important school of psychology is the school of psychoanalysis founded by Freud. He was a neurologist by profession, and he used to treat nervous and mental disorders by hypnosis. In course of his practice, he made the happy discovery that if the patients were allowed to relate, his patient was allowed to relate his story and thus mentally relive his past experience, he was greatly relieved of his trouble. This was what he formulated as a principle of, well, or hypothesis. He started using the talking out method in place of hypnotism. And this method revealed to him that the experiences of past conflicts, frustrations, continue to persist in the human individual. He therefore posited the subconscious as a fact in order to explain their persistence of this persistent of past experiences. He was soon led to think that the subconscious is relatively the larger part of man's personality. In fact, as he later chose to put it, the 9/10 of human personality is subconscious. But in the employment of the talking out method, we discovered that the past experience did not always easily come up. More often, parts of the experience were held back. And this observation made him formulate the theory of repression. How does repression take place and what is the mode of its operation? The investigation of repression constitutes the main line of work of psychoanalysis. The symptoms of the mental diseases are significant. They are willed by the patient in the sense that they afford the partial satisfaction to the repressed impulses. The normal behavior is influenced by these repressions in the individual. Even small slips and errors of behavior are subconsciously determined by the repressed impulses. These repressed impulses of the human being, Freud, traced to the sexual impulse. The repression here consists in forcible suppression of the sexual impulse by the social and normal pressures upon the human individual. According to Freud, sex impulse is coextensive with the whole of the pleasure-seeking propensity of the human being. He has shown the working of the sex impulse in the child from birth to adolescence. The working of sex instinct, which to Freud is the most fundamental, is the characteristic of psychoanalysis. Well, every human activity, even religious, moral, and artistic, is simply a manifestation of this original sex impulse. Interpretation of dream is another contribution made by psychoanalysis to modern psychology. Dreams, according to it, betray the subconscious as probably nothing else does. Dreams are not fantastic and meaningless play of imagination. In his attempted scientific formulation of the explanation of dream, Freud maintains that all dreams are wish fulfillment. Overt or covert repression in man seeks gratification in his dreams. Jung has contributed to the study of nature of personality and to the understanding of the action of human groups by positing the collective unconscious. By an extensive study and analysis of myths, legends, customs, and early cultural history of many races, he arrives at the collective unconscious as the psychological substratum which explains the behavior of the individual and of the groups of men. The late Dr. Anand Kumar Swami also made a very extensive study of a comparative study of myths of the human races. This positing of collective unconscious indicates that Jung abandons, by implication at least, the naturalistic stand in psychology. For one can ask, where does the collective unconscious abide? Is it in the material or non-material medium? Is it of the vital or the mental stuff of which it is made? So far as the study of human personality is concerned, Jung admits that the roots of personality are veiled in mystery. I'm quoting from his book. Well, the terms collective unconscious remind the Indian student of the term collective consciousness and perhaps of cosmic consciousness already used by the ancient sacred books. This cosmic consciousness and even the supracosmic transcendent consciousness mentioned in the Indian books are at present superconscient to the ordinary human psychology, but they are regarded as capable of being experienced by men if certain psychological conditions are fulfilled. Sri Aurobindo, in his two books, The Ideal of Human Unity and Human Cycle, points out that a slow growth of the dynamic collective consciousness has been taking place in humanity. The growth began with the family, developed through the clan, the tribe, and has now reached the nation unit. This impulse has its roots deep down into the insect and the animal world, and even below in the vegetable and the inconscient. There is thus a gradual unfolding of the soul of human collectivity, of which humanity would be the highest vehicle. Dr. Haridas Chaudhary finds this collective unconscious a blanket term, as he calls it, and he says that it is too inadequate to carry any exact sense. To Jung, the collective unconscious is not a state of consciousness, because according to him, a relatedness to an ego is an essential condition of consciousness. This is a limited view of consciousness, as it takes for granted the mental as the only possible consciousness. All spiritual experience, including that of Sri Aurobindo, always speaks of the ultimate reality not as unconscious, but as supreme and infinite consciousness. It does not depend upon, nor does it require an ego for its support or reference. It is spoken of as the golden Purusha, the golden light, and the unconscious is described as dark. Sri Aurobindo speaks of it as luminous, uttermost superconscious, as against the dark inconscious. Jung's failure to realize the distinction between the two, the superconscious infinite and the inconscious infinite, well, is responsible for his description of the ultimate reality as collective unconscious. This is a brief survey of the present-day schools of psychology. All of them deliberately leave out the soul. But certain psychologists, while rejecting the soul, seem to admit interesting substitutes. They affirm a subject who is the knower of all our mental activities. They said that they find such an admission essential. To say that psychology is a natural science and therefore has to reject metaphysical conception and yet to maintain a subject as necessary is to equivocate. This entire field of differing and conflicting schools of contemporary psychology raises the fundamental question, how to arrive at a firm basis for the science of psychology? That, in fact, is the moot point. We have already said before that modern psychology is not a science like physics or chemistry, and if at all it is regarded as one, it is in its infancy. busy collecting data of facts and studying merely primary processes. All explanations therefore attempted by it under the present imperfect state of knowledge should be regarded as tentative. It is hoped that integral and an all-comprehensive psychology will emerge from this imperfect state, and that the different schools of today may find their reconciliation in the most comprehensive science of the future. It can be safely affirmed that a true basis of our mental life does not seem to have been grasped by these groping contemporary schools of psychology. It reminds one of the blind man trying to describe the elephant. Even though many years have passed since William James wrote the conclusion of his book on psychology, I think that the ideas he expressed therein hold good even today for the present field of psychology. This is what William James writes. When then we talk of psychology as natural science, we must not assume that means a sort of psychology that stands at least on solid ground. It means just the reverse. It means a psychology particularly fragile, and into which the waters of metaphysical criticism leak at every joint. A psychology all of whose elementary assumptions and data must be reconsidered in wider connections and translated into other terms. It is, in short, a phrase of diffidence and not of arrogance. It is indeed strange to hear people talk triumphantly of the new psychology when into the real elements and forces which the word covers, not the first glimpse of clear insight exists. A string of raw facts, a little classification, and generalization on mere descriptive level, a strong prejudice that we have states of mind and that our brain conditions them, but not a single law in the sense in which physics shows us the laws, not a single proposition from which any consequences can casually be deduced. We don't even know the terms between which the elementary laws would obtain if we had them. Then he adds, this is no science. It is only the hope of a science. The matter of science is with us. Something definite happens when to a certain brain state a certain consciousness corresponds. A genuine glimpse into what it is would be the scientific achievement before which all past achievements would pale. But at present, psychology is in the condition of physics before Galileo, and the laws of motion and of chemistry before Lavoisier, and the notion that mass is preserved in all reactions. And the Galileo and the Lavoisier of psychology will be famous men indeed when they come, as come they must. Someday, surely, for past successes are no index to the future. When they do come, however, the necessities of the case will make them metaphysical. Meanwhile, the best way in which we can facilitate their advent is to understand how great is the darkness in which we grope, and never to forget that natural science assumptions with which we started are provisional and revisable things. This is from Psychology, a Brief Course by William James, page 464. I think with that we close the survey of modern psychology.